Columbia presents Corwin. Tonight, in the fourth of his new series of broadcasts, Norman Corwin brings you his latest play, Savage Encounter, featuring Carl Frank, with Arnold Moss, Joan Alexander, and an original musical score composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann. Savage Encounter.
My name is unimportant, and you'll understand soon enough why I must omit certain details from the telling of the story. I was flying a seaplane in an area of the South Pacific en route to my base when I ran into a heavy electric storm. For over 3 hours, I flew blindly, not knowing where I was and unable to see what lay below me. It was getting dark, and I had about 20 minutes of fuel left when suddenly an upcurrent caught the plane and lifted it with cyclonic force 6,000 or 7,000 feet in a few seconds. And then, as though I were coming out of one dream, only to enter another, I was above the storm. And I saw rising before me a mountain peak silhouetted against the pearly wash of a clearing sky lit by the full moon. There was nothing to do now but fly with the wind, negotiate the extremely narrow pass, and bail out on the other side. But once through the pass, I was dismayed to see dense forests on the other side. I jumped, having no other choice. The wind was so strong it carried my descent for miles. I finally hit the treetops with such force that I must have been knocked out, because when I awoke, it was day. I was in a forest, and there was a green glow all about. Occasionally, a shaft of sunlight slanted through when a tree swayed in the wind. Gradually, I experienced an instinctive alarm, and for good reason. There was something behind me. Something had been in the brush watching me for I don't know how long. I got to my feet, but whatever it was that was standing in the gloom didn't move. I took a step toward it. With a quick movement, the branches between were cleared, and there came forward a native. He was about 7 feet tall, handsomely proportioned, his skin a coppery bronze in the shadows. I addressed him. Speaking English? He looked at me with fixed expression. I tried again. You know how speaky? You friend, white fella? He came closer, studied the wounds on my face for a moment, and then said an astonishing thing.
What dialect of a decent tongue are you mouthing?
You speak English. Oh, that's wonderful. I was afraid I might have come down in enemy territory. Oh, say, this is all right. Have a stick of gum? What island is this, anyway? Where's the base around here?
Base? Enemy territory?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Why, don't you know? Japs. You mean you don't...
Has your wound diswitted you?
This what?
Well, whatever this cumbrance around your feet, cast it off and come with me.
Well, it's a parachute. I bailed out in it last night. It saved my life.
An extern, kindly and familiar, yet a tongue wilder than the chatter of a tree churro leaping the vines.
What did you say the name of this island was?
Come with me. Come. Follow me.
He led me down to a stream along which we traveled for some time. During this, he said very little. Most of the way, he preceded me on the narrow trail and so couldn't speak conveniently. But at one point, he stopped and turned to me with a wide grin.
Yes, we speak English.
Where on earth and on what had I stumbled? Was I in a delirium? How else to explain the language of this native? His speech was certainly English, but it was a kind I'd never heard before. Antique, archaic, stilted, strangely formed. We finally arrived at a place which by my own promise and by all I hold sacred, I cannot describe to you. It was a fair place, a beautiful place. That's almost the only way I can describe it. It was modest and livable, but above all, there was a dignity of life in that place I'd never seen before. My rescuer and guide took me through curious and animated crowds to a place of assembly where a council was in session. They rose at my entrance, greeted me with silent nods, and listened to my friend's report. He delivered it with high humor, telling how while hunting, he'd looked up and seen an odd object descending in the sky.
And I thought, what a riggish pollen coming on the wind to breed with trees and make new combines of flora. For we see so much of jesting nature here. Fish flipping to the fin tip and birds jocose from sunrim to night peep. I was prepared for some out-country creature conceived upon a mountain riverbed by low-lying vapors. And as he had not been discharged by any cloud that I could see above me, I discounted him a dewdrop.
I saw the laughter wasn't at my expense, for they seemed kindly disposed to me, and when my discoverer had finished, the leader of the council came over to where I was standing and took my hand.
We welcome you to these woods, to the fruit of our gardens and the produce of our hands. We invite you to take of us and be of us, to convive happily, both in our own name and in the name of Thomas, your brother, whose memory is quick and ageless among our nation.
I was too dazed at the moment to make any special note of his reference to Thomas, for immediately the others of the council approached and took my hand, and each greeted me with sentiments similar to those of their leader. Something was said about my needing rest, and I was taken to a cottage overlooking the gardens of the But I must be careful not to describe too much of this place. Again, for reasons you shall see. I was numb from my head wound and intoxicated by the brilliance of my surroundings, but once I'd had something to eat, I yielded to fatigue and fell into a deep sleep. And as though every level of my consciousness had been affected by this experience, even my dreams, unlike the nightmares of the previous night, were pleasant and full of exotic music. Whether out of my own resilience or from something tonic in the atmosphere, I woke up fresh and clear-headed, my injury well on its way to healing, my spirits unaccountably light. And the events of that day served only to heighten this feeling. To begin with, I was regarded by everybody with a sort of open affection I'd always thought the province only of lifelong friends. Children flocked around me when I went about in the streets as though I were a favored uncle. There was no superstition or mystic awe mixed up in it. People of the place simply were happy to see me and didn't hesitate to show it. On the fifth evening, there was an occasion in my honor, music and dancing and the speaking of poetry. But even if that night hadn't otherwise been charged with sensation, I should remember it all my life for one thing. It was then and there that I met Ara, the daughter of the leader of the council. Ara of the blue-black hair and eyes that outshone the proudest constellation in the heavens. Ara. Oh, blessed name. It was Ara who told me about Thomas as we walked by the lake shore afterward, hands clasped. How a man was cast up on the far shores of their island 3 centuries ago, the only survivor of a shipwreck.
Tall as we, your color, white-haired. A legend writ of him in after years swore that a cloud sat on his brow, a very cumulus of consideration.
How he'd been a profound and good and forceful man and a student of the great poets of his time.
Yes, Shakespeare and Marlowe and Webster. He bore their sea-soaked pages as a libbird carries her young. Purposefully, tenderly, yet with a haughty and a prideful eye.
How he'd found her people so gifted of intellect, so benignly civil, so acquisitive of knowledge that he gave up all thought of returning to his own country. He lived among them, telling them very little of the temporal matters of his own world, but teaching them all the best of its poetry. And so great was their native genius for the spoken word, so complete their fascination in it, that soon English got to be their second tongue.
And, growing supple with usage, became at last our elected speech, for we pitched upon it.
This, then, explained the peculiar idiom spoken here.
Quite as you say, a transplanted language, flourishing like some windblown and accidental seed dropped in a foreign soil.
Apparently, Thomas was hitherto the only white man they'd ever seen, and I was, in effect, the first bulletin from the outside world in more than 300 years. Thus, I suppose it was natural they should think me of the same stripe as the sainted Thomas. For my part, I fully reciprocated the kind attitudes they displayed toward me. And as for my feelings for Ara... It started the night I dined, or convived, as they put it, at the place of Tarim, Ara's father. I was talking with an elder named Chargo when, in the course of conversation, I began to expound on the subject of my adventures in the war. I recounted briefly the history of its wars, its industrialization, its panics, its depressions. They listened without a word, at times looking at each other quizzically, but never interrupting. Tarim made a little gesture as if to speak. I stopped.
You tell us, then, that foes slaughtered 20 millions of each other with cruel murdering pieces?
Yes, from 1914 to 18.
Killed. And now, today, simult with our sitting here, your nations are at killing once again.
Yes, about 20 million killed in this one so far, and it's not over yet by any means.
And nothing learnt between? Nothing extraught from the many wars and bloody garboils?
Oh, sure, in a way. We've learned how to kill more efficiently. War's a full-blown science now.
Tell us more.
I went on, encouraged by the amazement and astonishment on the faces of my hosts. When I had finished, I sat back, pleased with my account. For a moment, nobody spoke. And then Tarim rose.
The night is old, and the moon is set. We must part now. Our fellowly guests shall be escorted home, but I would have the council remain.
I thought it peculiar that the party which had started so informally should end in this manner and that I should be assigned an escort when up to now it had been considered quite all right for me to go around alone. And I was still more puzzled when, as I was leaving and started to cross the room to say goodnight to Ara, I was intercepted by Chargo, ostensibly for the purpose of asking me a question. It was a small, pointless question, and I'm sure it was merely a ruse to delay me, for... upon disengaging myself from Chargo, I noticed Ara was no longer in the room. The attitude of my hosts seemed to have changed. They were still courteous and kind, but I found that fewer people spoke to me, these less freely than before. I was detained close by my cottage on this excuse and that. What concerned me even more was the fact that though I'd been seeing Ara every day since we'd met, she was now mysteriously absent from her father's house. I made inquiries for her, and Tarim explained.
Ara has gone to the lakes on errand.
Oh, when will she be back?
I cannot say.
I returned sullen to my cottage and was shocked to find that on the pretext of needed repairs to its roof, I was being moved up into what they called the High Holt, a wooded section some distance from the gardens. The new place was even larger and more luxurious than the old one, but I was aware that the warm and open hospitality of the country had deteriorated into a sort of protective custody. And as this process continued, I became uneasy and wretched, more so for want of news of Ara. And then, late one sleepless night, a night when all the wild beauty of the land lay tranquil under a southern moon, I started up from my brooding at an unaccustomed noise. There was someone at my window. With my eyes half open, I feigned sleep, but at the same time, with a stealthy movement of my hand under my blanket, I grasped the knife I'd been keeping under my pillow ever since being removed to the hold. I waited. For minutes, nothing stirred, and then something happened that made my blood freeze. No sooner had a cloud drifted across the moon and darkened the woods than a figure slipped swiftly through the curtain of the window, noiseless as a shadow, and was standing in the room above me. I rose to my elbow, my fingers tight around my knife. Who is it? Who's there?
It's I. Ara.
Oh, Ara.
Oh, my older Lethus. Danger.
What danger?
Marked you out as savage.
I, a savage?
Yes. They say you come by greed and savage, but they dread you will subvert our youth by story and example.
What do they intend to do with me?
I fear they will devise for you to die on an unsuspecting moment.
But I thought they liked me here.
They respect you fondly, but they're fearful lest all innocent... You plant the cancer of your dispiteous world among us.
But I wouldn't do that.
You must go, beloved, or they...
Why did you come?
Because I love you. And I am for law.
Oh, Ara, my darling.
And all a mort without you. I...
There, standing in the doorway, were two giant native guards. Silently, they came over to Ara. One gently took her arm, and she went out between them, not speaking a word. They didn't say anything to me, except to apologize for the disturbance.
We regret to have intruded on your privacy. Good night, sir, and deep sleep to you.
I expected my food to be poisoned, so I didn't eat. I expected to be killed in my sleep, so I didn't sleep.
Shall the bed be readied?
No, I'm not tired.
You have not rested since noonstead, 2 days.
I tell you, I'm not tired. I'll let you know when I am.
We await your pleasure.
I expected them to pounce on me when I walked around the hold, but nobody came near me. Finally, I couldn't stand it any longer.
Guard!
You call, sir?
See here, I've had enough of this. I demand to see Tarim immediately, do you understand?
He shall be told.
I was sure this wouldn't do me any good, but to my great surprise, later that same day, Tarim arrived at the Holt. He was downcast, seemed much older than when I saw him last, as though he'd been through a terrible ordeal. He bore bad news. Arrow was being held for treason, and the council had decided I must die. I asked him what they'd do to Ara.
She, too, was under sentence.
You made up your minds?
All but to hear you.
Hear me?
Our code is to inform the accused one of our charges, then to hear him out.
What good will that do?
Little. Less than little. Naught. Unless you are persuasive against the damning testaments of your own lips.
You're putting me on trial, is that it?
Yes. They are putting you on trial.
However painful to our ancient hospitalities, do it we must. For then and only then, good judges, can we be proof against unimaginable woes. The war, by his report, engluts all of the oceans of the world, save for this haply mirage-hidden island. How long, if he escape and does rejoin his usual barbaric company, should we stay unconsidered in their strategies?
But you have my word, I'll tell them nothing about you.
His word? Respected judges, he himself has told us of the history of treaties in his forlorn society.
You're willfully misinterpreting what I said the other night.
This prosecution is small pleasure to us all. Consider him. In face, resembling Thomas. In language, uncouth but understandable. A brave and hardy fellow, outwardly a worthy and a gracious man. Yet, inward, what decay sits still and waits. How else than by a vile inheritance of blood could lusts and fratricidal passions so control the children of the fighters of the wars that they, the children, persist in making up and fighting new wars of their own? Is there no love among their schemes? Good judges, these are the risks of an acquittal. First, that he escape. Next, that, staying in our midst alive, he, by ingratiation and insisture, by devices uncanny such as that which he calls radio, by the same perversions of wit and skill which have rendered this race of savages sovereign over the bird, will subtly and wickedly corrupt our people. Already he but touches a maiden, the noble daughter of our noblest leader, and she so deep contracts the special sickness of this savage that she hurries through the night to betray her people by forewarning him. We all agree and are together saddened that this very personable and by certain lights this innocent young man should, for the sake of the tranquility and peace of generations yet unnumbered on this island, be forfeit of his years and die under the sentence of this council. Yet, these are good causes that I account here, the highest of all, and he, alas for him, is overmatched by them. For in his world, by all that he has freely told the many of us here, there is such bale, such epidemic misery, hunger amid great riches, and the lessons of catastrophe continuing unlearned, we cannot but assume some awful growth is rampant in their blood, breeding in cycles, and affecting finally the very seat of reason. Our guest, so logic and quiescent now, like Thomas of that old and better world, may be the carrier of a black and mortal plague striking the inner organs of the soul. We cannot risk this prospect in our nation. I call upon you to pronounce the edict of his execution in the name of the various peoples by whom you have been here deputed.
These are the weights against you, good friend, our guest. We shall listen if you wish to speak.
I certainly do wish to speak. First of all, get rid of any idea that I'd willingly stay here if you were to reprieve me on condition I don't try to escape. Because I would try.
He pleads the case against himself better than we.
I'd try to escape to the very war which you condemned, by whose conduct you consider me a savage.
Why?
Because I still have a share of fighting to do in that war. And not even for this sublime island and the dignity and sweetness of your life here would I remain here while other men are dying for a cause which I consider just as sacred as you do your own. Listen. Any fool could understand your caution to keep the thing you have. But let me ask you something. Was it always this way here? Did you come out of the earth complete with laws and culture? It doesn't matter whether you came up from the tadpole or the ape. Somewhere along the line you had to fight. You had to conquer beasts. Or else be conquered. Well, that's the way it is with us today. We're fighting beasts, animals far wilder than anything you've ever had to face. We're fighting the makers of wars, and that's not easy for people who, like you, are brought up to prefer peace. If you kill me, then there'll be one man less against the beast. And if he wins, don't be so sure he won't eventually find you for all the freakish storm fronts that protect you. I found you, didn't I? You make the mistake of lumping together as savages the makers of war and the breakers of war. There's a difference between the two, and men are willing to die for that difference. We call them men of goodwill. And there are millions of them, fighting for just such a kind of life as you've got here. Do you mean to say you deny to others the blessings you have found? Can you mean that you're willing to take but not give? You took what Thomas had to offer, and you found it good enough to make a saint of him. Well, I can tell you there are many other Thomases, present and future, who can bring you countless good and wonderful things, and will, after we've finished with the fascists. Before this war, all of our countries were islands like yourself, each one of us, cut off in spirit from the rest of the world as you are cut off in fact. But now we're together, and the leaders are meeting. And one nation gives to the other what it needs, as you people do here among yourselves. Well, that's where we stand. As for you, you can sit alone if you choose and hoard your riches like a miser counting gold. Or else you can help those who are poor in wisdom to reach what seems to you so obvious and easy simply because you reached it so long ago. In a very small way, you can start helping by letting me go back to fight. But whatever you decide to do to me, what about her? She's accused of treason. Why? Because she ran through the woods to warn the man she loves? That's not treason. Treason is deliberate and studied, not a girl's panic for the safety of her lover in the night. Is there no love among your schemes? I say to you, release us. Let her go. Let me go. I'll make a vow to tell nobody where to look for you. At least not until our civilization is worthy of your acquaintance. That's all I have to say.
Goodbye, my old Elisist. Go safely, and my love be constant with you.
Goodbye, beloved, beloved Ara.
May you find the way to your people, and may your people find their way to peace.
I'll try to come back, Ara. And if I can't, my world will come to you. And it will be a part of me as I'm a part of it.
I shall dream forever of the all of you.
Once more I fill my eyes with your face, and then I go. All right, friends, a blindfold.
Here. Does it bind you too close?
Oh, that's comfortable.
So, take my hand.
And so, blindfolded, I was led up the slopes and through the pass. It was an extra precaution on the part of my host, but quite unnecessary. One day, when all the savagery of inhumanity to man is rooted out, when all the many inequalities are evened up over the whole of our known world, when we have won, I shall borrow a plane. I shall head for a certain quadrant of a certain ocean. I shall look for a storm to get lost in.
You have been listening to Columbia's presentation of Savage Encounter, written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin for CBS as the fourth program in the new series Columbia Presents Corwin. Carl Frank was featured in the role of the pilot, with Joan Alexander as Ara and Arnold Moss, Paul Mann, and Gregory Morton as natives. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.